Welcome to the People First Leaders podcast. My name is Doug Utberg, Marine Corps veteran, and I have absolutely nothing to sell you. The purpose of this commercial-free show is to honor the leaders who approach life as go-givers by putting their people and customer value first. Stick around until the end of the show, and we'll reveal how you can be our next guest in about 20 minutes. Let's go. All right, we have Nathaniel Harding with us today, and what we are going to be talking about is why people are assets in a business. So what I'm going to do is I would actually like Nate to introduce himself and then cue up why that is his view, because he's the one who suggested the topic. So Nate, please introduce yourself.
Yeah, well, thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here. And so, yeah, you know, Nathaniel Harding, I'm a managing partner of Cortado Ventures. And, you know, we are a venture capital firm managing $100 million. And we invest in high tech, high growth companies. But my background, I'm from Oklahoma originally. I've been all over, but always called Oklahoma home. And we focus on this part of the country, an area that we call the Mid-Continent. And so I have an engineering background, also was in the Air Force, done a lot of neat things. Yeah, thank you so much. And I've been very fortunate to do a lot of cool things. And I think this is the best one yet, being a venture capitalist.
Okay, well, that is awesome. All right. And so, okay, so this is going to be, this is very interesting because many VCs, not yourself clearly, but many VCs have a reputation for essentially basically treating people as though they're disposable objects, similar to like, Kleenex tissues. So you very clearly have a different philosophy. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So it's actually kind of makes me kind of laugh because, you know, when VCs talk about how much money they manage, the term is assets under management, which refers to the dollars. But to your point, you know, really what we're, you know, our assets are who we invest in. And I think an important point is, you know, I come from a background as being an entrepreneur and an operator. You know, I've built and operated and sold companies. I've raised money, you know, and I've had to work with financial investors. So I understand, I have some empathy for what it's like to be on that side of the table. So when I decided to, you know, to come to this side of the table and be an investor, we really wanted to have a different approach and have a founder first mentality. And, you know, that manifests in many different ways. But, you know, an example would be sometimes we get asked, you know, well, do you serve on the board? Like, do you control the companies that you invest in? Do you serve on the board? We do not have a controlling interest. We do sometimes serve on boards, but importantly, we provide free executive coaching to any of the founders of our portfolio companies that want to do it. Which is really unusual. You'd be hard pressed to find another VC that does that. But that's really investing in the person, and actually, you know, we pay for it. It's executive coaching that has a cost, but we bear that cost because we think it's just important to have that coaching mentality and to have the ultimate low barrier of free.
Okay, that's outstanding. That's excellent. Well, okay, so you piqued my interest a little bit because you're very clearly different from many of the other VCs that are out there. So kind of walk me through how you got to your current business model a little bit.
Yeah, so my background, a little bit more detail on it because I think it helps, is I'm an engineer. I was mechanical engineer by degree, petroleum engineer in my earlier career, civil engineer in the Air Force. But what most of my civilian work was working for a large oil and gas company before working for the family oil and gas company before doing my own. But a theme that emerged across all that was using technology to really improve processes in what's, let's just say it's like a legacy, you know, an old industry, like a very heavy industry of oil and gas. You think of big equipment, huge operations, you know, it's a very built up environment, heavy, you know, heavy infrastructure.
Yeah.
But using technology, in many cases, digital technology to improve processes, to save cost. And so that background kind of gave us our thesis, which is there's a whole new world of digital technology that's infiltrating in what we call the built environment. So it could be energy infrastructure, it could be manufacturing, logistics. So sometimes we say we're atoms, you know, we're bits meet atoms.
Yep.
Right. Yep. Where and so that intersection, you didn't see a whole lot of that in the 20th century, but more and more, and thanks to a lot of the development that has happened over the decades, it's now possible to see digital technology be very useful and transformative in these heavy industries. And so that was, that background kind of gave me some of that insight and some of that experience and those connections, and then informed our model now, which, you know, we started Cortado Ventures in 2020. And structurally, it's a venture capital firm. Like there's nothing unique about the actual like legal model of it. The SEC very much considers us a VC firm.
I was just thinking about that. How, is it possible to create a unique legal model for a venture capital firm? There's not that many different ways you can cut the onion.
Yeah, and if you try too hard to be cute with it, then you might get into some trouble. And so, but also, you know, keep in mind that, you know, we survive by raising money from limited partners. And so in order for us to have capital to deploy in companies, we have to go out and raise that money. And so we kind of have two audiences. I have the audience of, I raise money from limited partners or LPs, and they have certain expectations. They have financial return expectations, but also they have like structural expectations. If I'm being innovative on how we deploy the capital, it's probably just too much to also be innovative on how we structure raising the capital. So what we offer is we are a venture capital firm, just like you would find in Silicon Valley. But where we are different is that, you know, we focus in a part of the country that's overlooked in sectors that are sometimes considered unsexy, and bring that founder first mentality.
Outstanding. Outstanding. All right. Well, okay. I am really intrigued because you were talking about how you can be creative on how you raise capital or creative on how you interact with investors, but it's usually not a great idea to do both. I'd love it if you would unpack that a little more for me.
Yeah. So, I have to remember that when I'm meeting with potential LPs, and, you know, over the last year and a half, I've had, you know, probably over 1,000 meetings and three times that, and just, you know, other interactions, emails and correspondence. And you get, you know, they look at all kinds of funds and to invest in all kinds of venture capital funds. And they got to be able to compare apples and apples, right? So at the end of the day, they want returns. They have different metrics they use. So early in the life of a fund, you can look at the unrealized rate of return. You know, that's one early metric and indicator. So, you know, we view it as, we also have the terms of the fund. And so you have things like management fee and the net profit carry. So they have to be able to compare us to others and say, well, this firm has these fees, this kind of carry structure, but they have this kind of return profile. They can compare that. They can compartmentalize it. But then they look at, what does Cortado or whatever, you know, fund bring that is unique? What is their unique approach to alpha creation? At the end of the day, we got to create alpha, create returns better than, you know, risk-adjusted returns better than the stock market. And that's where the novelty comes in. That's where your novelty in your insight, in your sourcing, and how you support companies. That's where creativity is rewarded. But you have to be able to compare financial returns across an asset class.
Okay, excellent. And yes, I think that alpha part is really important, because what a lot of investment funds do is they basically try to sell beta at alpha prices, or at least that's what I say. Mm-hmm. Because your typical, your old hedge fund model would be 2% of net assets and then 20% of profits. That's what they call alpha prices. You know, if you are charging prices like that, you need to be delivering returns that are uncorrelated with the market. And sorry, I'm going on a little bit of a rabbit trail, but I think it's important, because I think a lot of people believe that alpha means you are outperforming the market, which could be the case. But in a lot of cases, what is going to drive your alpha isn't as much your overall rate of return as much as if you were uncorrelated with the S&P 500. In other words, you know, it's, you know, if your fund is flat when the S&P goes down and your fund is up and the S&P is flat, and, you know, if you are not moving in the same direction, that will drive a very low correlation, which will make your beta low, which can make very high alpha if you are fully uncorrelated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's an interest that a lot of investors have is, you know, they're looking to diversify across different asset classes. And venture capital is a great way to do that, you know, because we're seed investors. So we don't really care what the stock market looks like now, because our companies won't be going public for 10 years. And honestly, we may be out of them by then. Yep. You know, so we have pathways to liquidity, you know, before, you know, preempting an IPO, and our companies don't use debt. And so there's very little correlation to interest rates. It can be more difficult to raise capital when interest mm-hmm. rates are mm-hmm. higher, just because everybody doesn't have as much liquidity. But other than that, you have a lot of, you don't have much correlation with where people put a lot of their capital, and you can dramatically outperform. But venture capital is an asset class where, if you look at a distribution of performance, mm-hmm. it's a very wide bell curve. And so you really want to be in the top quartile funds.
I'm taking us on a little bit of a tangent because our original topic was why your people are assets. And I solemnly swear I'm going to get back to that, but this is just so fascinating because the return profile for your typical venture capital fund is going to be that are basically around 5% of your bets fund everything else. It's like you usually, typically it's about 70 to 80% are just complete failures. About 15-ish, 15 to 20% are kind of singles or doubles. And then you'll get about 5-ish% are your home runs. And so the model that a lot of VCs depend on is having a few home runs that finance everything else. Are you on a similar, do you follow a similar power law, or is there a different model that you have deployed?
I mean, we absolutely recognize that the power law is just a fact of physics in venture capital. But instead of either denying it or just trying to live within it, if we can get one more winner mm-hmm. than the average, if we can, just skew the odds more in our favor, or a better way of saying it, one thing that we do is we're very intentional and relatively aggressive on our follow-on strategy. Mm-hmm. And so an example would be we might do a smaller pre-seed or seed check. So we might invest in a company that's like pre-revenue with a relatively smaller check, let's say less than 500,000. Uh-huh. And then we'll be very intentional with the company, working with executive coaching and providing back office support to increase the odds of success for them to get to that next stage. And then we may triple down, right? $1.5 million check, and then maybe even do it again in the next round. So if you walk that out, for one, you're dollar cost averaging your way into the company.
Yeah.
You're getting, very affordable option value. And then when you math that out, about 80% of your company ends up in your top 30% winners.
Yeah.
In other words, that's acknowledging the power law curve, but then taking advantage of it. And that's really how we look at it.
Okay. Well, I think that's a really smart stair-stepping approach. I mean, because especially if you're talking seed or pre-seed, I would imagine that a lot of those are going to be at some kind of discount to your Series A. So, assuming that you are the Series A, then you can basically be setting up a discount to yourself.
Yeah, and you have information asymmetry mm-hmm. relative to other investors. And in many cases, you'll have an insider round that's like a bridge to the next full round.
Yeah.
So you're able to pile in more at a discount to the next round. So there's lots of, and then you can be on the inside helping the company succeed. I mean, we want all of our companies to succeed, but if we can improve the odds from what the industry average of 25% graduation rate to mm-hmm. what our companies have, which is a 60% graduation rate.
Really good.
The proof is already there. Our graduation rate for our seed companies is more than double the industry average. So we believe that our approach is working, that we're pushing more companies towards the fat side of the power law curve and then piling more money into them.
Yeah. Well, and again, I solemnly swear this tangent's almost over, but I'm having a lot of fun with this conversation. Well, because the thing that I like about this, as opposed to, I mean, because you can also create high rates of return if you go in like highly leveraged to real estate, or like say if you hit the stock market at the right time and you're highly leveraged. What I like about this is that you are getting your operational leverage through high growth businesses that presumably do something of value, otherwise they wouldn't be growing rapidly, versus just using debt to leverage up something that is not materially different than what anybody else can do.
And by not being leveraged, the worst we can perform is zero, as opposed to negative infinity. Right.
So that's important to understand. People don't get when you have leverage, negative infinity, that's the bottom. Zero is only the middle. There's a really big difference.
Yeah. Well, and it's also kind of like since we can influence the outcomes, you know, if you're playing the stock market, there is information asymmetry and you're on the losing side of it. Yeah. Whereas with what we do, we're on the positive side of the information asymmetry, and we can help influence the outcome. And so those are all things that, you know, it's a lot of work, and it requires some, you know, some special insights and having an amazing network. Mm-hmm. But those are all things that we work really hard to accomplish.
Outstanding. All right. Well, now I'm going to keep my promise and we'll get back to the original topic of people being assets. So walk me through a little more of kind of what, you know, how you mentally unpack that, or, you know, the way that you think about that. I think we started on there, but then we got into a little bit of my nerdy interest in the way that well-run VCs are managed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so actually it ties in well, because for us to do what we just described, we have to have the right people involved, mm-hmm. right? And so it's frankly not enough to be smart. And it's not enough to be passionate, but it's also, you know, it's really a combination of both, but also have the right skill set and insight for the areas that we invest in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, our team, I really view it in three different buckets. And so, you know, it all starts with our investors. Our investors absolutely are an asset to us, of course, because they give us their money and entrust us with that. But also, we actually lean a lot on our LPs for expert insight. So an example would be, let's say we're looking at a company, we're considering investing. It is pre-revenue. And so you really have to get validation from the market. And so we actually lean regularly on our LPs to pilot the technology or to, you know, hear the pitch and give a reaction. That's a tremendous asset. It's better than any, you know, ChatGPT or, you know, any textbook that I could look at to try to understand the technology, is simply to put that founder in front of a potential customer and get the candid feedback from somebody who could be a great channel partner and customer, or it could be a quick no, which may be disappointing for the founder, but you know what, at least now they're getting that feedback and can make a course correction and maybe spend time on a different iteration that is more fruitful. So it starts there. Our own team as an asset, that's where, you know, I talk about the, you know, the talent, the skill set, the passion, and the right fit. You can have two different firms that are structurally identical and they have the same strategy, but, you know, just slightly different caliber of people and have wildly different outcomes. Mm-hmm. And it's borne out in different studies, but, you know, but it's also something that you see it in everyday practice, because a lot of, especially in venture capital investing, it's the art of the new. We're investing in the future. We are all the way in on uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And so having high quality people that can navigate that uncertainty is in and of itself a tremendous asset, and, you know, treating your people right. And we take great pride in having a tremendous, you know, positive culture, you know, standard of excellence, and that we trust each other to do what we say we would do. And not only for each other, but also to our founders, which is the last category. You know, the asset that we own is equity in these startups, and they're run by people that are, you know, these entrepreneurs that are taking the risk to build something new. They probably had a lot of people say that they were crazy, but they went for it anyway. And it's been said, and I fully believe, that it's better to invest in top tier founders that honestly may have just like a okay product than it is the other way around, because that top tier, you know, that top tier founder is going to get that feedback from the market. And they're going to make a correction, you know, because they have what it takes, and they have the tenacity and they have the support to be able to make that course correction and to find product market fit. Mm-hmm. But they have to be a high quality entrepreneur to be able to do that. And that's so we really focus more on the founder and recognize that treating the founder right, both in the process and then after we cut the check, that's what's going to create those returns. But it's also what's going to keep business coming to us, because if founders don't come to us, then it all dries up and it doesn't work. And so we have our reputation, and treating founders with that respect and empathy is very much an asset and not just a nicety.
Oh, that's excellent. I mean, Boy, yeah. If only more people approach business with this with the same philosophy. Well, in fact, and so let me kind of get on another like micro tangent, which is, why do you think that your framework is not more widespread?
Yeah, I think especially if you come from like the private equity world, like growth equity world, it's there's very much a like mine mentality, you know, like or you know, secrecy and proprietary information, and so and that's actually I say this because I really actually came from that world, and so you know, I came from a world where we were backed by you know growth equity, private equity investors. And you know, not casting judgment on character, but just you know, describing a culture that I think is fairly accurate. That since those investors are taking control interest, then they want to control it, and so they want to control the process. They don't want to share with other investors. And whereas it's built different, and anybody who's I think has a good approach to venture capital is acknowledging that it's a team sport. You know, we have to get along well with other investors. With what we call ecosystem builders. And so a good example is we work with partners that run accelerator programs that help founders launch their idea. Mm-hmm. Well, we want to be their first call whenever that company launches. And so if we have that good reputation, then that will happen. But also we want to help put together a round. We want to bring other investors to the table to invest, to close out a round with the company so they can go on about the business of running it. And you have to have good relationships to make that happen. But so many other pockets of business aren't designed that way. And either just because it's developed that way over time, or there's some perception that it has to be that way. But really it's more of a growth mindset that it's, you know, it's not if I succeed, you, Doug, don't succeed. It's we can actually both succeed, right? You know, so if I do a good job being your guest, then your podcast will be incrementally, you know, I'll be another great episode, and then you succeed, my story gets out, so we both win. And I think that growth mindset is something that I really, you know, I don't always succeed, but I try hard to adopt that myself personally, and it manifests in many different ways. We try to teach our kids that, you know, like you can always learn more, you can always just do the hard things, and keep growing. I think that's something that I try to aspire to.
Just wonderful insights. I love that way of viewing the world. I mean, because if just my observation, I feel like there has been a short-term focus that's really pervaded a lot of the business environment. I mean, not just recently, but it feels like it's accelerating. And I think that, you know, because, you know, in order to, you know, to really have that holistic perspective, I think you need to have a longer time horizon. You know, you can't be concerned about whether this quarter is going to meet guidance, or you can't be like solely focused on whether this quarter is going to meet guidance or exceed guidance if you're going to implement what you're talking about. So I guess the question behind the question then is that in order to do that, one of the things that you will have to do is your investors, you have to help condition them to a longer term perspective. Now, do you find that they come in that way, or is that an influencing and or education process that you help them go through?
Yeah, so that's a good question, because there certainly is a lot of trying to lay out expectations. And we, you know, we have some investors where this is their first VC fund. We have some institutional investors that are in 50 VC funds. And so, you know, the latter obviously just, they're going to have that experience. And so they're not learning with you, but yeah, especially with fund one, like a lot of fund ones, you're starting off with first time investors, people that just believe in you, right? And want to take the plunge with you. And so I do think it's important for any business person or just human being to be very candid about expectations and try to lay out like what you think, you know, what that looks like. So that way, you're aligned from the beginning. You know, but you do, we're all people, we all have, you know, short attention spans. And so you will kind of get, I think early on we were saying like, expect distributions in year five, you know, and we're in year, for fund one, we're in year three. And, you know, you start getting questions like, where are distributions? And we actually have our first one coming imminently. So like a year and a half ahead of schedule. And so that happens. And I think, you know, we all have, I keep in mind that we all have busy lives and we all, you know, keep track of a few things that are near and dear to us, but everything else is is tied for second place at best. And so, you know, I try to remind myself, you know, we had our annual meeting recently and I kind of took more of that perspective. And so we spent more time on education at the beginning of the annual meeting, not presuming that everybody remembered what we said last year. We, you know, we kind of had a little bit of educational pause of like, okay, here's the metrics that we track. Here's what we said we would do, you know, and took that time and then went on with the report, and we got tremendous feedback. And, you know, people were just very thankful and that really walked away with a great understanding. We'll do it again next year, you know, because we won't presume that that we're top of mind for everybody. So I think having some of that humility and understanding that of that perspective, and if you just take that on yourself and approach it that way, you're going to get a better reaction. I think people always feel better when they know they're being spoken to candidly and authentically and with respect, as opposed to trying to be, you know, talking over them or trying to make yourself sound smart at their expense. Even if you have great facts and great stats and great performance, they're going to appreciate the you know, being treated with respect.
Yeah.
Now it's all about DPI. It's all about distributions to pay it in. So respect, authenticity, and DPI is a way of the winning formula. But if you can be really open with that communication, you're going to get a much better, you know, long-term relationship, because that's what it is. To your point, you know, investing in VC is a long-term relationship.
Yeah. Well, and I would think, especially because if you're talking about, say, distributions to pay it in, as you said, there's a 3 to 5 year lag. And so, you know, even if somebody comes in saying, all right, yeah, 5 years is fine with me, it's like you said, year three, they're saying, okay, there's distributions. When are these things coming? So I think that's where maintaining that relationship along the way is really important. And then, and I know this is one of the things that I've always worked with, is that, you know, I've generally found that what I feel is over communicating, other people usually find to be under communicating. So, and in a lot of cases, I find that I have to push myself to say things more times than I feel like is probably necessary, because just if everybody else has so much going on that I can't necessarily assume that they remember the last time I said something.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think people have to hear things multiple times.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if it's like when you're, you know, candidates run for office they have like the talking points, and it's like, you roll your eyes, how much they have to say it. Well, that's how many times they have to say it for like 5% of the population to absorb it. And so, you know, if you're committed to getting that message across, then you got to keep that in mind.
Standing. Well, I introduced you as Nathaniel. Do you go by Nathaniel or Nathan? I should have started with this.
Oh, no, yeah, no, Nathaniel. It's actually funny, because I in high school went by Nat, like N-A-T, just Nat. And, but then people would be like, are you saying Matt, like Matthew?
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, I hear my mother's voice being like, I named him Nathaniel, so that's what it is. But no, it's all good. Anything's fine.
All right. Well, Nathaniel, really appreciate you coming on the show today. And just let us know where we can find more. Where can we, what's your website? Where can we find you online?
Our website is cortado.ventures, and we explain everything about what we do, our criteria for investment, the sectors that we look at, and a simple 1-minute survey that a founder can fill out information and get an immediate response on if it's not a fit and why and where to go, if it's potentially a fit and to schedule a meeting. So make it super easy for founders that are building cool things, but also the same place for, you know, our insights. You know, we publish content around, you know, how we're thinking about investments. So that's a great place to find it. It's just cortado.ventures. And all of our social media handles are just Cortado Ventures. So nobody else has taken it. So we have it. You can find us on, you know, X, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. So all the places.
All right. Excellent. Nathaniel, thank you so much for your time today. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, me too, Doug. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the People First Leaders podcast. If you are a successful People First founder or CEO who would like to be on this show, please visit peoplefirstleaders.net/guest. If this interview resonated, would you please share it on social media? Just take a quick screenshot on your phone and post it on your favorite social channel, then make sure to tag me at Doug Value so I can give you and your business a shout out on a future episode. If you know somebody who'd be a great guest, please tag them on social and include the hashtag #PeopleFirstLeaders. I really love seeing your posts and guest suggestions. We're releasing new content and episodes all the time, so make sure to hit the subscribe button so you don't miss any new episodes. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and they mean a lot to me personally. And also, I would like to connect with you on social. My handle is @DougValue, or you can just go to peoplefirstleaders.net where all of the links are posted. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.